Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation titled Refining PSA Response: Insights from Recent Post-Hoc Analyses on Ultra-Low Thresholds of PSA and Their Clinical Impact. I'm Dr. Jack Andrews. I'm a urologic oncologist and surgeon scientist at Mayo Clinic, Arizona, in Phoenix.
And my name is Alicia Morgans. I'm an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a GU medical oncologist, as well as being the director of the Adult Survivorship Program at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston.
Today, we're going to talk about how the therapeutic landscape in metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer is rapidly advancing, with new clinical evidence and treatment options emerging. This MedCast series examines the latest developments in patient care, from innovative combination approaches to emerging clinical trial data. Join us as we explore evidence-based strategies for treatment selection, the role of different therapeutic combinations, and approaches to personalizing care for our patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. Joining us in this conversation is Dr. Murillo Luz, who's a urologic oncologist at Mount Sinai in New York. Thank you all for joining us today. Let's begin.
All right.
Okay.
Well, welcome, Murillo. Thank you so much for being here. Let's start off by just talking about some of the recent developments in the field. At the most recent AUA, there was a post-hoc analysis of ARANOTE that was specifically looking at PSA responses. But before we discuss these results, can you really share just a quick refresher of the design for ARANOTE? What was the patient population? What were the top-line results?
Of course, and thank you for having me today. It's an honor to be with both of you, experts in the field as well, and I'd have the opportunity to discuss a bit about metastatic castration-sensitive disease. So, going straight to the point, the ARANOTE trial was an interesting trial that was designed in randomized phase three trial that was designed to test the addition of darolutamide to ADT compared to ADT alone. So, pretty straightforward trial. Population, kind of all comers, we can say. I mean, there's no much restriction, low volume, high volume, visceral metastasis, low PSA, high PSA. So all kind of patients with metastatic castration-sensitive disease. Of course, this is first-line treatment. And they were randomized to receive ADT plus placebo or ADT alone versus ADT plus darolutamide. Was 2-to-1, actually, the randomization. So two-thirds of the patients actually got darolutamide and one-third got ADT alone. So, and primary endpoint for this trial was radiographic progression-free survival. So the trial took place in the last few years, was presented last year at ESMO for the first time, and then published at JCO. And we could see actually a clear benefit of adding darolutamide to ADT for the primary endpoint that was met, radiographic progression-free survival, with a hazard ratio of 0.54, which means 46% reduction of radiographic progression for this group of patients. That was, if you can take one point on time, like at 24 months, this was like 70% of the patients that were not developing any progression for the combination ADT darolutamide compared to 52%. So this was really a clear benefit of adding this drug. The safety profile was actually pretty, I mean, impressive and pretty good. I mean, we had experience with darolutamide with other trials, ARAMIS, ARASENS trial before, and now we could see that the safety profile was the same. Was actually at some point it looked that darolutamide was even better than placebo for the safety profile, but maybe this is now, just about the numbers. But of course, no new signals for any safety profile. And finally, for some of the secondary endpoints, they're very important for the patient, point of view, which means patients developing castration-resistant disease, which is a very important endpoint for prostate cancer, time to PSA progression, time to next therapy for the next treatment, the need for the next treatment, and pain progression, which is very important, for quality of life of the patients. All of those secondary endpoints were shown very positive and very clear benefit of adding darolutamide to ADT. So that was the ARANOTE trial. That was the last one on this in this scenario that was published.
Yeah, I think ARANOTE was exciting, and it's now led to FDA approval for darolutamide in the hormone-sensitive space. It's one more tool that we have in the toolbox. And one thing that's come out of ARANOTE is looking at this ultra-low PSA threshold. And as urologists, it's one of the frustrating things we see post-prostatectomy when we define undetectable PSA as less than 0.1 and patients are getting their PSA checked elsewhere, and we tell the patient, don't worry, 0.02, 0.03 doesn't mean anything post-prostatectomy. But we've seen some data that Neil Shore has presented about the ultra-low threshold and its role here. Can you talk a little bit about the rationale as to why they looked at that and why that might be more relevant in this patient population?
Yeah, that's a very nice scenario. We lived there in post prostatectomy scenario a few years ago. I remember during my fellowship, the minimum PSA that I would get was below 0.1. That was the result for like 80% of the patients who have that result. So we didn't even know about any PSA that was like any detail of PSA, any granular data there. But now we have ultra sensitive PSA, and it was natural for us to try to explore. It's the lower the better. So if you can really get even lower, and now we got to 0.2, we had all the information from Maha Hussein and all the other experts showing that this was really relevant to have a very low PSA. It was really prognostic, and then we tried to explore even more. So now something below 0.2 or below 0.1 or now below 0.02, which is like really what we're calling now the ultra low PSA. And that was the rationale. And actually, we are seeing more and more evidence now from different trials, actually, not just from ARANOTE trial, but from different trials showing that this is very important. This is prognostic. This is something that really we could use in many ways, actually, not just to counsel patients about what they expect for the next years with the disease. But also maybe to compare trials, to develop new drugs in this scenario, or to discuss about MDT or radiation to primary tumor. So there are many things I think we could discuss about this ultra low PSA, but this is becoming our routine to really test. And there was a difference even between this very low threshold. So I think this is it's new information. It's very important. And for the ARANOTE trial, it was shown that the addition actually would reach much more a very low PSA or ultra low PSA as we're calling right now. So that was such a clear difference. If you see more than 40% of the patients actually getting combination ADT darolutamide getting this ultra low PSA compared to almost like 80%, 8%, like 7.8% of patients that getting ADT alone. So you see how intense is this addition of an ARPI in this scenario to get a good PSA response?
So, Murillo, I wonder though, it's super important that more patients are getting to that ultra low PSA level when they have the intensified therapy, the combination of ADT and darolutamide when compared to ADT alone. But how does it really matter? Does getting to that PSA level actually associate with any clinical outcomes of importance? I think this is really one of the things too that we want to make sure of. Getting there is one thing, but does it mean something?
Correct. I mean, this is very important. At some point, we say we're giving too much attention to the PSA. Maybe it's not that important, to have the PSA. Patients are doing well, radiologically, not progressing. Doesn't make that much difference. But actually, we're showing here now with this post-hoc analysis for the ARANOTE is that actually that makes a difference. Even in between, this very small differences of PSA can make a difference. So this was really correlated to outcomes for patients. So we can counsel patients that if they reach that very the ultra low PSA or PSA below 0.02, of course, the benefit of the main endpoint of the trial, which was radiographic progression-free survival, was really much difference when compared to patients that did not reach the same low PSA. So that was kind of 90%, a very intense difference, completely different what we could expect for those patients for radiographic progression-free survival and also for time to metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. So That's what we always try to avoid. No one, there's a quote that says, that was not my quote, that no one dies of castration-sensitive prostate cancer. So every patient actually, the worst scenario is always a castration-resistant disease. So very important endpoint. And the difference is, if you get that ultra-low PSA compared to patients that don't get that PSA, was really important. So it's not just a number, not just a test. It's very related to the outcomes of those patients. It could use as a prognostic. And as I said, maybe we're going to even think about doing something different for those patients. So I think that that's where we are now getting that discussion. So it's just prognostic. Okay, fine. We know that those patients will do much better. We know that adding one ARPI on top of ADT, it's good to reach that point. However, if we don't reach that point, or for those that we are getting there, maybe we do something different. We maybe de-intensify, or we intensify on the other side. I think we're getting there. This is pretty exciting.
Yeah, I think those are some great points. I mean, multiple things we could talk about there. You know, you mentioned prognostic value as a biomarker. While not predictive, that could inform you to intensify therapy. Okay, and say, you know, this is a young guy, we want to be more aggressive. You know, for the urologists out there that might manage post-prostatectomy PSAs and then also manage hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, one way that, you know, I kind of conceptualize why in a post-prostatectomy patient, less than 0.1 is undetectable and many men with ultra-sensitive might be above 0.02 but are still cured is it's likely not metastatic disease, micrometastatic disease. It's probably not even cancer. It's probably a little bit of benign glands. But once you're in that metastatic state and you're getting treatment with doublet or triplet therapy, that ultra-low PSA might be giving us indication of either resistance to treatment, development of resistance, or just that microscopic disease that is really a surrogate for the burden of disease that might pop its head up later. And last year, not just Aeronope, but the Titan trial had a post hoc analysis that looked at ultra low PSA decline with apalutamide plus ADT. So how did those results compare to the Aeronope post hoc analysis?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's very impressive when we see the difference in results, even with the difference between very low PSAs. I mean, if you compare 0.2 to between 0.02 or 0.2 or even below 0.2, I was actually impressed that we could see that difference with that small amount of difference in PSA. So we're talking about 0.02 or 0.1 of PSA of difference there. And if you compare like 0.02 to 0.2 or above, this is 90% of difference in radiographic progression-free survival. So this is really impressive. I mean, we knew before, I remember that you just mentioned about the era after surgery that we, at the beginning was 0.5, then it changed for 0.4, then 0.2. Now we are maybe thinking about even lower. We're going to do something. And for the metastatic, I think the same thing is happening, although the concept is a bit different. And many trials are exploring or will explore that in the future, I'm pretty sure. Even the trials that were already done, that they can go back in the data and check, or the new trials can actually use ultra-sensitive PSA. So the Titan trial did that same analysis, and they showed the same thing. I mean, very similar, that adding apalutamide to ADT would create much more patients reaching this very low. So it was like 23% for patients with the combination compared with 5% of patients with ADT alone. It was not that intense with darolutamide. Any difference that with as many discussions we could see, because with darolutamide we reached more than 40% actually of patients getting that. It was 23%. That means that one drug is better or worse than the other. I think it's tough to say. It's not a head-to-head comparison, but that will create many, you know, food for thought definitely for the future to we think. So we know for other trials and for other drugs that yes, we're getting better results and reaching more patients with an ultra low PSA. And the magnitude of that correlates with even a better benefit for when comparing drugs. It's tough to say right now, but maybe we're going to use that as a comparison in the future. But we could see for different ARPIs, the effect is there.
Yeah, it's so important, and it's really reassuring, I think, that there is this consistency of the different studies finding that this intensified approach is really going to help us have more patients reach that lower PSA. So it's nice to know that we can get there. And I wonder, do you think that this is going to be a new benchmark as a urologist when you're starting these therapies, you're monitoring PSAs? Do you feel like the ARANOTE study and also the post hoc analysis from TITAN and other studies, because there have been others that really are looking at these low levels as well, do you think this is going to help us validate this less than 0.02 kind of ultra low as a target, as a benchmark that we really should be meeting when we're treating our patients with mHSPC, if we can get there?
I think so. I mean, maybe we're going to use at some point. I remember we started to create some very new data and new fancy tests to see if one drug was even better than the other, or to try to see how much effective that drug was. Like, so some molecular testing. We did a lot of trial. You could see tons of analysis for those trials, actually, with those more fancy and expensive tests. And now we see that with a very simple and cheap test, which is PSA, actually we can have a very important information. So this is very nice. I mean, usually medicine is one of the areas that every time we have something new, usually it's more expensive. It's rare. I mean, in engineering, when you have something new, it's cheaper than before. In medicine, it's more expensive than before. So, and here actually we found something that is cheaper than any other, super test that we could create now, and it's there, it's available. Urologists, we love PSA. We are so frustrated when a medical oncologist will come to us and say, no, at this moment of the disease, you don't need to take care that much of the PSA. We're always frustrated. So we like the PSA. We like to test PSA. Our patients are so used to have PSAs when they do active surveillance, when they are after surgery or after radiation. So I think it's really nice to use that. It's easy to evaluate. So the fact that it's there and the information, it's so available for so many trials and for almost every situation that you have in prostate cancer, I think, yes, of course, they would use how strong this benchmark is going to be. Then it's not to me to say at this moment, but it's yes, I think we're going to use as a benchmark. We're definitely going to use this to compare efficacy and to compare arms between different trials.
Yeah, really good points. I really like that you highlighted the ease of use of PSA because we're already familiar with PSA, right? There's so many biomarkers coming out, whether they're genetics or CTCs or extracellular vesicles, whatever they are across the spectrum that we're not familiar with, we've never used before. And the penetrance of use is going to be really limited if you're not as familiar with it. And with PSA, particularly, these ultra low thresholds or kind of the existing 0.2 threshold makes it a lot easier to use it. And you really highlighted some of the differences between just a small change from 0.02 to 0.2. But if we look at the higher threshold of 0.2, if a patient doesn't reach that threshold of less than 0.2 at 3 months, how is that going to change your management of that patient? Would you change therapy? Would you give them longer time on that therapy? Would you add an agent? How do you manage that now that we have this data that highlights a difference in outcomes?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think now we're going to start to use actually this information, not just for prognostic, but maybe to do something different for those patients, which is very exciting. Now we can individualize a bit and not with, as you said, molecular, circulating DNA or any of the genetic tests or any of the super imaging tests that we have nowadays, but with the PSA, actually can maybe tailor some of the treatments. We can maybe tailor some of the follow-up for those patients. If they have very nice response, maybe should we be doing imaging every 3 months, every 4 months, every 6 months, or maybe we could be a bit more relaxed with this group of patients. And for those that really, as you mentioned, they don't reach that level of PSA, okay, this is a group that we really need to be a bit more careful with doing more imaging, maybe doing following those patients closely. I think this is something really that is important for us. And changing therapy, it's a very nice question. So if you're doing a doublet and you don't see that PSA, we got that. I think Alicia, we had that discussion at some point in some other meetings. And you start your doublet. You see some response, but you don't see that response that you wanted. It's not reaching that low PSA. Should we go for a triplet therapy even before this patient developed castration resistant disease? I mean, of course you guys know about the triple switch trial that's actually testing exactly this situation. So at the moment that the patients don't reach the PSA, now they are being randomized to stay on doublet or then add chemotherapy, which is a very interesting approach. If you want to be very academic, I was trying to remember, I mean, I was an investigator for the Arasense trial as well, and I was trying to remember the timing for the Arasense trial. But the timing actually allowed patients to get screened into the trial after 12 weeks of ADT. And you have 6 more weeks after screening to start docetaxel. So if you add 12 plus 6, you have 18 weeks. So let's say you take that decision in this 18 weeks, you still will be following exactly what was done at the Arasense trial, one of the main trials testing the triplets. So just like to play a bit with the mathematics here, but I think everyone is leaning to do that. I don't think this is a standard of care for us to say, okay, I don't have a good response of PSA, let's add chemotherapy. I don't think this is so straightforward so far, but the concept really attracts me. I think it's really interesting and rational for that. And maybe one of those trials would actually answer that question for us.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that understanding the contribution of each of the things that we add into the care of our patients is so helpful to us and really helps inform decision making, and it makes sure that we're doing things that actually are going to benefit the patient. And using the PSA, which I agree with Jack, it's so nice that you highlight that this is readily available, easily testable. You know, we can all do it. It's not an extra burden on the patient. There's no additional cost over something we would normally be doing because we do it anyway. Using that as a gauge is just helpful. It's something that if beneficial is going to be easily disseminated around the world to help with treatment decision-making. So I think that's great. Going back to basics though, you know, what are you thinking about? Just clinical factors when you're trying to choose one of the AR targeted agents and you're treating a patient with metastatic hormone sensitive or castrate sensitive prostate cancer, how do you choose between these things?
Yeah, this is always a tough question. And, as usual, we try to differentiate a bit. There's a lot of similarities and a few differences between the options, among the options. And of course, we try to see usually comorbidities, you know, side effect profile for each patient. I try to go, it's hard to go in details for every drug, for every patient, new patient that will come. We'll take like 3 hours of every visit. So, but I try to at least have a flavor of each drug for the patients, for them to understand a bit of differences that we have, but it's hard to go like really deep in the details of each of those treatments. But of course, drug interaction is something important for me. That really most of our patients are taking many of the drugs, comorbidities, some specific subgroups. Now we have some data showing that maybe abiraterone is not that effective for an older population. I know it's not like super strong data, but yes, it's important data that maybe we could take into account. And again, and then go to over some of those questions and see some of the patient expectations about some of the side effects that could be affecting those patients. That's the way we try, but it's never an easy decision. And we always try to, share that with the patient with some of his expectations as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. I like how you describe that. Some of these drugs have just a little bit different flavor. I say the same thing to patients. I tell patients there are a couple different flavors of radiation. It's a good way to get that across to patients. Kind of switching gears. At the AUA in 2025, there was a spotlight on disparities. And Dr. Trin looked at a sub-analysis in the ARANOTE trial, particularly with Black men with prostate cancer. And that's an area that's of a lot of importance and much needed clarity. Can you give us some of the takeaways from that analysis?
Yeah, I think it's very important. Kwaka is not close to Alicia anymore, and he left. Now he's at Pittsburgh now. He's a great guy and good friend. And he did a great job actually in doing a sub-analysis of the ARANOTE trial. we every new trial that we have, we have nowadays, and even when recruiting for trials, we are worried about diversity with those trials. Some of the trials are actually being designed to really favor diversity, because there was a problem with many trials in the past that at the end, it's not on purpose, of course, but at the end, you end up having a very specific or not too much heterogeneous population at the end of a trial. And what Kwok did with this subgroup analysis was very nice. I mean, he saw that Black patients had a higher median baseline, like PSA was even higher, was like 90, 99 compared to 21 for the whole population on that trial. By the way, 21 was quite high for a clinical trial in this scenario. I think it was the highest that we ever had for trials in this scenario. So 21 as the average for Aranode. But for the Black population was 99. So we expect to have a bit more aggressive disease in that scenario. And the proportion of high volume disease was actually a bit higher, 78 to 70, the comparison. But what they saw was actually that the benefit was still there. So for that population, it was around like 10% of the trial, which could be better, but was already good. I mean, it was a good representation, of the Black patients in that trial. And the benefit was still there. Actually, the benefit was by 49% of reduction in radiographic progression-free survival, which was the primary endpoint of the trial. So it was very, very nice to address that, to see that population being represented in the trial and to see that the benefits are still there. But again, we saw that this population would come with a more aggressive and more advanced disease, which is very important. It's something that we really have to take into account.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I'm really appreciative also that you highlighted the differences in prognostic factors associated with the Black patients who are included in the trial. And one of the things that I think is important as we move forward, certainly in our clinical practices, but also in our clinical trials, is something that you alluded to, which is that, you know, we treat many Black patients in our practices and around the world. And so it's important to have representation in our clinical trials. And some trials, actually a long time ago at this point in time, but they were very novel and exciting when they came out, actually focused on comparing responses to treatment and differences in adverse events that could occur during treatment with the same drug, but in populations of white patients versus Black patients. And some interesting things fell out of that. You know, I wonder from your perspective, what changes, what measures can be taken that might improve some of the disparities in our practice and also this disparities that exist in terms of enrolling in clinical trials?
Yeah, definitely we need to keep making an effort. I mean, we are already trying, I think, in the last few years. One of the things that are really nice being practiced here in New York, I mean, especially at Mount Sinai, is that I have a very diverse population here in my clinic. So it's very nice for me. I can see, and I can see some of those differences. So try to really go against those all the classic barriers that we have for access to good care. So I think this is something that we really need to keep following, and we're doing something here at the urology department at Mount Sinai, but this is kind of initiative that should be anywhere, not just for practice, but for the clinical trials as well, to try to include that population, to really be proactive in seeing how much we are including and how much we can get more of that population involved in the trial, why they don't want to come to the trial, they don't have access to the places that the trials are running. So trying to see what's the problem. I mean, they have any issues with the trial, they're thinking they're not the best population to go for any specific trial. So trying to go really and face those barriers and bring that population, it's very important. And I can see even more here. I mean, I had that experience in Brazil before, and I have an experience here to treat the Black patients here in New York. And I can see that those patients will come with a more aggressive disease. I understand that it's really a population that we need to pay attention and really be very careful and include in our clinical trial, so to have good data at the end. And actually, even when we're including the clinical trial, already bringing a benefit. You know, it's good for the patients to be on clinical trials. So it's a win-win situation. They are there in the clinical trials, benefiting already for that. And then we have the data that could be applied for that population. So again, it's a win-win situation for them.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, we need to address whatever challenges that Black men are experiencing, whether it's increased genetic risk, access to care. But these subgroup analyses and making it a priority to get a diverse patient population enrolled on trials is important because we need to know that our treatments are going to work across the spectrum. And some treatments may work better for other patient populations. And so it's really good to get that information. I want to thank you, Dr. Luz. This was a great discussion. I really enjoyed talking about PSA thresholds and the prognostic value of ultra low PSA. It was a really fun discussion. I want to thank you, Dr. Morgans. This was a fun discussion. Thank you for co-hosting with me. And I want to thank everybody for listening today. I hope you had a good time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you, Jack.